This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a side-by-side look at Russian military action in Syria and Ukraine. Since Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine in February, the world has watched as the Russian military has used increasingly brutal tactics, targeting civilians with indiscriminate bombings and eliciting allegations of war crimes for atrocities in Bucha, Mariupol, and other places. The Kremlin has used similar tactics in Syria since 2015, when Moscow intervened to prop up the regime of Bashar al-Assad, who harshly and violently cracked down on a civilian uprising, which began in 2011 in the wake of the Arab Spring democracy protests. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. While there are several parallels between Russia's propping up of the brutal Assad regime in Syria and its invasion of Ukraine, there are also stark contrasts. Unlike in Syria, where President Bashar al-Assad requested and welcomed Russian intervention, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky condemned Russia's senseless attack on his nation's sovereignty. A recent tweet by Syria expert Charles Lister, a senior fellow at the Washington-based Middle East Institute, reads, quote, "Russia's invasion of Ukraine catalyzed a massive U.S. and NATO pressure campaign, sanctions, weapons, etc. For years in Syria, Russia bombed hospitals, IDP camps, and schools, besieged hundreds of thousands, covered for chemical weapons use and more. The response, nothing, not even a sanction," unquote. Lister goes on to tweet, quote, "I know it's been said before, but I still find it hard to wrap my head around just how cold and risk-averse the U.S. and allies were over Russia's role in Syria. And the costs are just staggering, not just to Syria and its neighborhood, but to the world at large. What an error," unquote. At the end of April, the PBS network's program NewsHour ran a story about how many Syrian civilians in Idlib province, who are in their 11th year of resistance against Bashar al-Assad and his ally Vladimir Putin, feel solidarity with the Ukrainian people, who, like them, have been victims of Russia's unrelenting aggression. Ahmed Abu Hajar, president of Idlib University, tells PBS reporter Ali Rogan, quote, "Of course there is one criminal, whether in Russia, Ukraine, or Syria, and that is Putin. It was Putin himself that targeted hospitals and schools, infrastructure, and educational buildings in Syria and in Ukraine," close quote. Well, for more on the points of convergence and divergence between Russian military action in Syria and Ukraine, we turn to two distinguished experts. Hussein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute, that's a think tank based here in Washington, and Mona Yacoubian. She's senior advisor to the vice president of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and both guests join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Hussein Ibish, let me begin with you regarding sort of the overall parallels and contrasts. As I indicated in the introduction, this Charles Lister quote, he and some analysts are making comparisons, regretting, you know, that the United States and other Western powers, and Arab powers for that matter, did not do enough to thwart Russia's intervention in Syria on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. Russia, we could easily argue, turned the tide of that conflict in favor of the regime, which has survived. What's your assessment?
Yeah, I think it's impossible not to understand that, in fact, the turning point in the war came in the fall of 2015, when Russia, Hezbollah, and Iran launched a joint intervention and military surge in Syria against the rebels backing up Assad's rather feeble military, which was losing. And the reason they did that is that the Iranians, who had, you know, lots of Hezbollah and Iranian boots on the ground in Syria in the spring of 2015, came to the conclusion that Assad was going to fall if there wasn't a very extensive and powerful intervention. Iranian officials, including the late Qasem Soleimani, who was killed by a U.S. drone strike in Iraq at the end of the Trump presidency, went to Russia with a proposal and maps and plans, and they did that. So I think clearly the Russian intervention saved the Assad regime. There was this very powerful use of military force in the Middle East for really the worst purposes you could think of. And indeed, Charles Lister is right. There was really no response. There wasn't much of a response, even diplomatically and rhetorically. There was pretty much no response on the ground. And as a result, Assad survived. The intervention was successful. And we have the situation now where there are just small pockets of the country that are not controlled by probably the most brutal dictator in the world, or certainly the most bloodstained one. And that's obviously a big contrast with Ukraine, where Russia's intervention met with a very stern and very extensive Western response in terms of economic warfare, in terms of sanctions, and also providing Ukraine not only military hardware, but also intelligence that helped them kill more than a dozen Russian generals. A lot of that was targeted thanks to U.S. intelligence. So there's been a thoroughgoing support for Ukraine, but there was really not much of a response to Russia's intervention in Syria.
Turning to you, Mona Yacoubian, for your take, how would you weigh in on the West's response to Russia's intervention in Ukraine compared to Syria?
I would largely agree with Hussein's analysis. I think he's exactly right. I'd maybe take it a bit further and say, I think at the time of the conflict in Syria, there was very little appreciation that what Russia was doing in Syria, it would take elsewhere. So I do think there was a sense that, well, you know, it's the Middle East, it's far away. I don't think strategists in the West imagined that Russia would take the very tactics that it was honing in Syria and use them in Ukraine, use them in Europe. Not that that makes it any more horrific. These kinds of tactics are horrific wherever they're undertaken. What I'd like to add is, you know, much was made about Russia testing all kinds of different weaponry and so forth in Syria, which is true. But I think what wasn't fully appreciated and understood are exactly the kinds of, basically the total and complete disregard for international humanitarian law and for the laws of armed conflict, which stand strongly against the targeting of civilians, which, of course, as we all know, tragically happened with regularity in Syria. And again, undertaken by Russia, also enabling the Assad regime to do so. And so we saw in Syria over now 11 years of conflict, the deliberate targeting of civilians, of schools, of medical facilities. We've seen Russia actually attack a UN convoy in Syria. This was in 2016, a convoy that was seeking to deliver medical assistance and aid to a besieged part of Aleppo. And nothing was done in response to that. We also, of course, saw in Syria, unfortunately, exactly the kinds of tactics we're seeing today in Ukraine, not just the deliberate targeting of civilians, but also tactics of besiegement, essentially cutting off cities. We've seen this in Mariupol in Ukraine, and we saw this in Aleppo in Syria and in the Damascus suburbs, where in an effort to essentially literally starve people into submission, in Syria you had the Assad regime backed by Russia, essentially cutting off these areas, not allowing for the provision of humanitarian assistance. These are basic needs that need to be met no matter what the situation, whether there's a conflict or not. And we also saw the use of proscribed weapons in Syria, thermobaric bombs, of course, chemical weapons in Syria. And this is the big concern, I think, going forward in Ukraine. Will Russia seek to use chemical weapons in Ukraine, which would pose an enormous challenge, I think, to the West, and not to mention, of course, the horrific impact it would have on civilians in Ukraine?
That is absolutely true. And so quickly back to you, Hussein Ibish, it sounds like a severe indictment of the West, and that's not to underestimate or underappreciate how they have rallied to defend and provide Ukraine with military and humanitarian aid. Nonetheless, many would say that from the very beginning, people in Syria and let's say the Baltic states, who are also very familiar with Russia's aggression, that Russia would resort to the so-called Grozny-like and Aleppo-like techniques of pummeling civilians and civilian infrastructure once they could not really conquer Kyiv in the amount of time that they had thought.
So you're right. You've seen the tactics in Syria. You've seen them, as you mentioned, in Georgia and in the attack on the Donbas and Crimea in 2014, Russia's first invasion of Ukraine, which was also sort of ignored. So it's not just that Russia's nefarious activities and brutality in Syria was ignored. So was the 2014 invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea. So there's a long history of the West and the international community kind of shrugging, condemning, and doing nothing much to push back against Russia's aggressions. Now, here's the thing. There are many differences. One of the crucial ones is that in Syria and in the first Ukraine invasion and in Georgia, we've seen the Russians very cautiously and with a great deal of discipline seeking to achieve very specific, very limited goals with specific limited means. And that you haven't seen in Ukraine, at least in the first part of the Ukrainian war. Instead, Russia was going all out for regime change in Kyiv. They wanted clearly to reduce Ukraine to a puppet state and also seize large quantities of Ukrainian territory, including all of Crimea, Odessa, the rest of the Donbas, and what have you. So, in other words, the big difference between those earlier Russian aggressions and this one in Ukraine is that there was, at least at the outset, an unrealistic goal with insufficient means. And so I think, you know, sort of Putin didn't learn his own lessons. He was sort of teaching the world how to get away with stuff. And in Ukraine, he clearly overreached very badly. And now he's in, you know, a terrible mess.
I'd like to pick up on something Hussein has said, because I think he's absolutely right. But I would frame it a little bit differently, which is, indeed, we talk a lot about Russia applying the lessons and tactics it honed in Syria in Ukraine. But I think Hussein is absolutely right. There's the Russian sin of hubris, where I think, in fact, Putin took essential wrong lessons away from his engagement in Syria. First, let's not forget that, like it or not, Russia was invited into Syria by the Assad regime. So it came in essentially uncontested. The Russian planes were not contested in Syrian airspace. They were there at the behest of the Assad regime. This is quite different, as we know, in Ukraine, where it's Russia who's the perpetrator of regime change, and Russia very much opposed and very much contested in Ukrainian airspace and on the ground. The second key error of hubris that we see on Putin's part, and this is something I've learned from engaging with Russian analysts over the years and how they view Syria. Russia, Putin specifically, views Syria as a post-West success, that the world is entering a post-West order where the U.S.'s power is diluted and where Russia can regain its greatness. And I think Putin viewed his accomplishments, in quotation marks, in Syria to be indicative of a deeper, stronger power that Putin was bringing to the table. He got that sorely wrong. He thought that, as in Syria, Putin was somewhat successful in putting a wedge within NATO. Putin began to try to pull Turkey, a NATO ally, away from the alliance. Putin sold Turkey sophisticated air defense missile systems. And this was a huge issue for NATO. I think he took the wrong lesson from that, that he could, in fact, fracture NATO. In fact, he learned that not only did he not succeed in fracturing NATO, NATO has now been galvanized and may well expand in ways that I'm sure Putin never imagined.
Very interesting. That's fascinating. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute, and Mona Yacoubian, from whom you just heard. She's senior advisor to the vice president of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And we're discussing the parallels and contrasts between Russia's intervention in Syria and its invasion of Ukraine. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower, Tariq from Yemen. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, I'd like to turn back to you, Hussein Ibish, because Mona Yakubian made some very interesting and important points about how Russia has taken the wrong lessons, in a sense, of its so-called, as we say in air quotes, you know, success in Syria. But she mentioned Turkey. Now, Turkey, as a member of NATO, has been opposing Russia's intervention in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the many negative consequences for Russia that has happened because of the Ukraine invasion, and that Putin obviously did not anticipate, is the way in which Turkey is serving as the primary frontline state. People tend to think of the Baltic states and Poland as the main frontline state here, but I actually think Turkey has a better claim to that than the northern NATO powers that we're talking about. You know, it's right there on the Black Sea. The fighting now, especially since obviously the effort to overrun Kyiv and install a puppet government there is at least postponed. The effort now is to seize large amounts of territory in the south. The fighting now is concentrated even more on Turkey's doorstep and, of course, in the Black Sea. And Turkey and Russia have had strained relations. First of all, they've been competitors in this region for hundreds of years. Secondly, there have been a number of incidents that the countries have had to turn a blind eye to in order to prevent a further escalation of violence. One of them involved Turkey shooting down a Russian jet on the Syrian border, and it was a part of Turkey's reaction to Russia's intervention in Syria. You also, very early on in the Black Sea, a Turkish freighter was attacked and badly damaged by a Russian missile. So I think Turkey, which has been estranged from NATO for a long time and has been kind of on the fringe, sort of barely a part of the alliance, has been driven into the arms of NATO quite thoroughly, at least for now and at least at that level. And that's a very interesting development. I think it's the last thing Putin would have wanted, but it's one of many negative consequences that he has created.
Mona Yakubian, anything to add or subtract about Turkey's role?
Yeah, I think Turkey's role, I would slightly differ with Hussein. I think Turkey's role, though it absolutely has opposed Russia in Ukraine in a variety of ways, as enumerated by Hussein, I do think Turkey has been striving to position itself as a mediator. And Istanbul and Ankara are the places where, to the extent any kinds of discussions are going on, and clearly things are in a very bad place on the ground, and so there's little prospect in the near term for any sort of political settlement. I do think Turkey has been seeking to maintain that position and, frankly, in a way, strengthens its position with the West, with the U.S. in particular, where ties had also been a bit damaged.
Exactly.
So it's using, it's leveraging its position. The other issue is Russia and Turkey have actually been fairly adept at compartmentalizing tensions. So, for example, they are on opposing sides in the conflict in Libya. And, of course, the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They've managed to address those challenges or keep them compartmentalized, insulate them from areas where they cooperate. So in Syria, we're not yet seeing the effect of a complete rupture between Turkey and Russia, which I think could have important and potentially destabilizing impacts on the ground in Syria. Now, how long that lasts, I think, is an open question. And I think much will depend on Russia's behavior in Ukraine. And if the Russians continue this all-out assault that's marked by atrocities and so forth, that may well be a breaking point between Turkey and Russia. We'll have to see.
It's also true that in Syria, Turkey and Russia found themselves at odds and also at other times cooperating, depending on the broader circumstance and what each side was doing. So Mona is exactly right that these are two countries that are willing to compartmentalize, much like Turkey and Iran do.
Exactly. Well, speaking of Turkey, Hussein Ibish, let's look at the refugee flows.
Yes.
In Syria, Turkey hosted millions of refugees. I mean, they really absorbed so many fleeing from the depredations of Bashar al-Assad and then the Russian cooperation. Mm-hmm. Jordan, Lebanon took their share of refugees. And of course, we know Angela Merkel is feted, you know, in Syria for having absorbed so many Syrian refugees, except that that created a backlash, as we know, in Europe.
Right.
But how would you compare and contrast the flow of refugees? We're seeing, of course, many of the Ukrainian refugees being received with open arms in Poland and so forth.
So it's very interesting. I do think you have to say that the countries that accepted Syrian refugees were in much less of a position to do that, especially a country like Lebanon, where Syrian refugees are now about a fifth of the population. It's huge. And Jordan also overwhelmed. And Turkey did accept very large numbers of refugees. And those countries, especially Jordan and Lebanon, are not really in a position to do that compared to, say, Poland or the even more well-off European countries like Germany and whatnot. The other key distinction is the refugee exodus from Syria was fairly slow. It's a huge number, but it emerged over years. And in the case of Ukraine, we saw vast levels of refugee flight in a matter of weeks. So that also is very different. But of course, in the end, there is the issue of ethnicity and prejudice. And I think it's clearly, I wouldn't say necessarily that that's a big factor in the differing responses in the West in terms of military action or what have you to Russia's intervention in Syria. But I do think you can clearly see how in Europe, in the United States, in the rest of the West, how much sympathy there is for Ukrainian refugees and a willingness to open the door to them, as opposed to fear and hatred in many cases in Europe, certainly, and the refusal in the United States of Syrian refugees. So they're not wondering who these people are. Could they be, in fact, terrorists? And one of the arguments that was frequently made by xenophobic anti-refugee, anti-asylum, anti-immigrant demagogues in the United States was, if you have a bowl of M&Ms and one of them is exploding, do you really want to keep that on the table? I mean, in other words, the idea that even if there are very few Syrians are terrorists, that one of them will be a terrorist if you let enough in. Really ugly, horrendous stuff that you have not seen applied to Ukrainian refugees. Now, over time, you might start to see some bitterness in parts of Europe if Ukrainian refugees become a big burden and if they are unable to go home. But another key difference is if the Zelensky government remains in control and if Russia is reduced to seeking some limited territorial gains in the south, a lot of the Ukrainian refugees can and will go back. And in Syria, I think it's been very, very difficult for refugees to go back. And in many cases, these are exactly the people that Assad does not want in Syria. Sunni Muslims who don't appreciate the Alawite minority rule in Syria, people who don't like the regime, people who are angry about the extreme brutality and bloodshed that has been forced on them. You know, in the case of the Zelensky government, they're fighting for the rights of these Ukrainian refugees. And clearly they're on the same side. Whereas in Syria, the government of Assad is on the opposite side of many, if not most, of the refugees that we're talking about.
Mona Yacoubian, Hussein Abish makes some very interesting and very important points about how the response differs or is similar with regard to refugee flows. You yourself have underscored the fact that it's very important to know that it was Bashar al-Assad, the leader of the country, who welcomed, who invited the Russians in, as opposed, of course, to Ukraine, where they were attacked. But nonetheless, what is your assessment with regard to differing responses? And I think we cannot ignore, you know, the ethnic dimension.
No, I would very much agree with how Hussein has framed it. I think it's a source of great pain, honestly, for Syrians and the Syrian community to see the differences of how Ukrainian refugees have been welcomed as opposed to the ways in which Syrian refugees have been treated. And again, one can't ignore, of course, differences of religion and ethnicity, but that doesn't make it right. And I think what's notable, though, about Ukraine, and Hussein touched on this, but I think it bears really thinking about, is that the pace of displacement in the Ukraine war so far dwarfs anything that we saw in Syria, believe it or not, so that there are an estimated 5.7 million Ukrainian refugees. That is in less than 3 months of conflict. That's the total number of Syrian refugees. It took 3 years, if not more, for Syria to reach that level of displacement. So to have that kind of massive displacement in a short period, it is remarkable that you are seeing European countries welcome the Ukrainians, which is a good thing to see, and it's heartening. But I also agree with Hussein, these are very, very different circumstances in terms of Syrians fleeing a brutal dictator. And sadly, in Syria, Syrian refugees, by and large, will not return to Syria as long as Bashar al-Assad is in power. So we have a much more, in Syria, a much more protracted crisis than will be the case with Ukraine.
That is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guests, Hussein Ibish. He's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute, and Mona Yacoubian, senior advisor to the Vice President of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.